U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Turmoil continues in the banking sector, which is raising a new question. Are regulators at this point doing more harm than good? And Chinese leader Xi Jinping arrives in Moscow in a show of support for Russian autocrat Vladimir Putin. How worrisome are the growing ties between the countries? Welcome to Potomac Watch. I'm Kim Strassel, and joined today by my brilliant colleagues, Joe Sternberg and Kate Batchelder Odell. So let's start with the banking sector. We're going on like day 10 of problems in that area, and things seem to be just as uncertain. At the moment, this very moment, there are talks led by JPMorgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon to potentially rescue again First Republic Bank. Over the weekend, Swiss officials engineered a forced acquisition of Credit Suisse by UBS, though only after the Swiss government had to provide some $9 billion to backstop some of the losses that UBS would take. And Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen today said that the U.S. might move to cover deposits of yet more banks if there are more runs, a statement that seemed designed to calm, but also suggests there could still be some big problems out there. Joe, amid all this, I guess I'd just make two points. One, more than a decade ago after our last banking crisis, Congress swooped in with this complex new set of rules called Dodd-Frank and told us that because of these rules, we'd never have a repeat. So I guess what we're seeing here proves not so much. But the other point is that if Dodd-Frank ever had any merit, it was supposed to be that it was providing some regulatory certainty, some rules of the road, what to do if there were bank failures, new rules on deposit insurance, new rules on banking debt. But if you look around at what's happened since this panic began and what regulators have done in the past week, they're just blowing up all those rules. And I think a good case in point is that Credit Suisse rescue, which I know you followed, which is now causing some turmoil in the market for bank bonds. Can you explain a little bit about what happened there and why it's a problem?
Yeah, Kim. So I think the first thing to understand is that after 2008 and the panic in that year, it wasn't just the Dodd-Frank Act in the U.S. That was part of a much broader global regulatory effort that was based around the same philosophy of regulation put forward by experts on this issue at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, the Basel Capital Rules, which were supposed to govern all large institutions around the world, and in fact applied to Credit Suisse, which nonetheless managed to fail over the weekend and be forced into the shotgun marriage with its larger crosstown rival, UBS. And I think the philosophy behind that was that the right kind of regulation could manage any important risk that might cause a large financial institution to stumble and threaten any kind of systemic contagion. And we're discovering that's not true because it's just not possible for regulation to manage every kind of risk. So, I mean, it might surprise you to know, actually, that in one sense, the post-2008 rules have worked because we are not stumbling due to the same risks that afflicted the banking system in 2008.
Just new ones.
Right. So the last time we were on this merry-go-round, the problem was credit risk or default risk. You know, banks were holding billions upon billions upon billions of dollars worth of primarily mortgage-backed securities in the U.S. that no one was able to value, that became very illiquid, that created these gaping holes on bank balance sheets. Well, okay, we've managed that default risk. The risk that no one controlled for is what would happen if banks had been operating in an environment of ultra low interest rates for 10 years, and then all of a sudden the interest rates and inflation go up. And it is that dynamic that is creating various forms of squeeze on institutions around the world. And surprise, surprise, the regulatory framework that we developed both to avert that risk and then to tell us what to do if it materialized anyway in terms of living wills for the banks or the kind of capital ratios they would need to maintain to protect themselves from that kind of 2008 risk. This is turning out to not be adequate, or, you know, worse, politicians and policymakers don't believe that those rules are adequate. So they already are veering from that roadmap. Credit Suisse thing is a great example. Credit Suisse had a living will that was supposed to govern a resolution in case it failed. It had very high capital adequacy ratios under post-2008 regulation. So it wasn't supposed to be in a position to fail in the first place. And yet it did start experiencing pressure from a major deposit outflow. And then the government in Switzerland turned out not to be willing to follow the rules of the living will and allow Credit Suisse to fail. So instead, they orchestrate this weekend shotgun wedding to UBS, which is exactly what we did back in 2008. How many weekends back then did you wake up on Monday morning to discover that there had been another big bank merger or some kind of bailout on Sunday night before markets opened? So there's a real sense of deja vu here, where you have the same lack of predictability about what regulators and politicians are going to do in a crunch, which then spills into markets. I mean, now the problem is that investors have no idea what the rules of the road are.
Yeah. And I guess to just add to that a little bit, not to get too deep into the weeds here, but as part of this whole deal that was engineered, Credit Suisse had issued these bonds to cushion itself in the case of a failure, these tier one bonds. And there was always an understanding that that could be wiped out if there was a problem. But under the old bank regulations, shareholders would have endured some of the losses. Instead, they're getting a lot of the money that comes from this takeover, whereas those tier one bond holders are getting nothing. That's a whole big change in the way everybody was looking at things too. So it's just injected so much confusion into this, and there's probably going to be litigation. So we're ending up with a much messier situation rather than those clear rules of the road. And Kate, I think that this is in a little bit of a repeat of what we saw when federal regulators swooped in at the very start of this to essentially bail out Silicon Valley Bank, saying that it would cover all depositors, even those who exceeded the 250,000 federal deposit insurance limit. And just today, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen gave a speech and said that the feds may well do it again. Let's take a listen to that.
The steps we took were not focused on aiding specific banks or classes of banks. Our intervention was necessary to protect the broader U.S. banking system. And similar actions could be warranted if smaller institutions suffered deposit runs that posed the risk of contagion.
Wow. So, Kate, that's set off a discussion in D.C. about a central worry that's growing here now. And the words to encompass it are moral hazard. The hazard of sending a message to depositors. They don't have to worry about their money, even if they exceed that FDIC cap. The government will just cover anything that anyone does, no matter how risky, no matter whatever. Kate, no doubt, Yellen thinks that by making these assurances, she's going to calm people who might be worried and go out and yank their funds from some of these smaller banks. But what kind of message is she sending more broadly?
Well, Kim, I think the risk, as you're describing, is a system in which all deposits are guaranteed. And I think it's worth talking about the problems with that policy, since I think it's being sold as just a sensible consumer protection to insure all deposits. Tom Honig, who was a vice chair of the FDIC, has given a lot of great speeches about how depositors who are inclined to withdraw their funds when they suspect a bank is unsafe are a check on banks' behavior. So it removes the incentive for discipline, that it encourages risk-taking by banks. And that is the exact behavior that we would like to prevent. I'd also echo what Pat Toomey, the former senator who was on the banking committee, has said, also that if you are insure all deposits, that's really a pretext for political control of the entire banking system. None of this would prevent excessive risk-taking. If anything, it would encourage it. And it also doesn't answer the question of why didn't bank regulators see this coming, given this duration risk was, like we said earlier, hiding in plain sight, that once interest rates went up, these banks could become exposed. So I don't think the deposit insurance is going to solve those problems. And it also creates a really new risk of moral hazard.
Yeah, it just seems like a lot of this is coming back to the regulators and their answers and decisions that they've made since all of this started, which seems to be causing as many problems as the banks have caused in the beginning. Joe, you mentioned, and it made me kind of chuckle, like talked about how a lot lot of this feels like a repeat of what happened the last time around. And kind of in that category, we've got this consortium, meanwhile, of all these banks that decided they were going to jump in here and rescue First Republic. They dumped a bunch of money into that San Francisco bank last week, some $30 billion in an effort to restore some confidence in the lender. But this is a bank, the stock market, it's now lost more than 90% of its value this month alone. Depositors have pulled out vast amounts of their money. So now there's talks to go even further and ramp up that rescue. Most of the reporting about this suggests that, you know, Dimon and his fellow CEOs are trying to reinstill some confidence in the banking system. But I guess one question I have is how central is First Republic's health actually to that wider banking system? And given all of these other extraordinary and kind of rule-breaking moves we're seeing from regulators, is this the right approach, or is there some merit to letting First Republic fail? What do you think of this effort? Where's that going?
If we're going to call First Republic systemically important at this point, I mean, what a huge indictment of the post-2008 regulatory environment. Because, I mean, the whole point of these reams and reams of banking regulations that Congress and various executive agencies have passed and implemented over the past more than a decade now was to reduce systemic risk. The whole point of it is that you're supposed to be able to allow even a big bank to fail, to have a resolution plan so that it can safely collapse if it comes to that and not filter through to the rest of the economy. And now all of a sudden we discover that we can't survive a deposit outflow at a couple mid-sized banks in California. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And I want to go back to the point that Kate was making about deposits and market discipline in this kind of scenario, because that is an absolutely crucial point. I mean, you can make a good case that banking has become so hyper-regulated and so many people have come to assume that there will always be bailouts that really big money depositors are the only people left in the banking system that actually have any skin in the game. And so they send very, very valuable signals. And it's notable that actually the deposit outflows have been concentrated in banks that turned out to have legitimate concerns about the stability of their balance sheets that need shoring up. We should be paying attention to that. And I think that we should also be encouraging more of what seems to be happening with First Republic right now, which is a private sector effort by other banks to step in to stabilize the situation before you end up in a situation where the government is putting the taxpayer on the hook to try to either arrange a deal from Washington or put taxpayer cash behind various guarantees to make a deal like that happen.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I'd like to see more of it rather than all the wailing that has come instead from some of these depositors and that has inspired regulators to instantly step in and put taxpayers on the hook for their bets. Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Chinese leader Xi arrived in Moscow on Monday in a strong show of support for Putin, the strongest since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. What's it mean for the West when we come back?
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Kim Strassel. I'm here with Kate Batchelder-Odell and Joe Sternberg. Chinese leader Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin met Tuesday in Moscow in what clearly seemed to be a summit designed to deepen economic and political relations between Moscow and Beijing. Both leaders in passive denounced what they describe as a U.S.-led geopolitical order and have called instead for a more multipolar world in which they play a more dominant role. China's been buying Russian oil to help Putin buck Western sanctions. They are expected to sign a new declaration of economic cooperation. But it seems to me that this really puts on the table the potential for very heightened East-West tensions. Kate, what do you think was driving Xi Jinping's decision to make this the first foreign trip of his third term, an unprecedented third term? What are Russia and China hoping to get out of this?
Well, Kim, we've already seen some, like you said, some economic deepening of ties there, and certainly certainly both of them want to trade with each other, and especially on energy and other things like that. But I think we should really focus on the larger stakes of this meeting, which they're being quite upfront about, which is to challenge the American order. Americans are used to living in a world where, for instance, the seas are calm and people don't invade their neighbors. And Russia and China are suggesting a new type of world that looks much different, where American power doesn't have as much influence on world affairs, and where they can exert influence on their neighbors through coercive means. So this is a real challenge to the U.S. in ways that I don't think that America has dealt with since the 1980s. And I think, practically speaking, a couple takeaways from this meeting is, one would be that China is not an honest broker on Ukraine. We've seen China try to kind of come in and say, well, we're here with an objective view and we'll try to negotiate a peace deal. I think this really shows that that's not a good faith offer. But I also think we are living through a sort of a bifurcating of the world. We also have Iran working with Russia and China, Iran providing weapons for Russia to use in Ukraine, some discussion of expanding weapons productions in Iran. So we're really seeing the world kind of bifurcate into these categories. And just pair that quickly with the Japanese prime minister's visit to Ukraine today. Japan has planted itself on the U.S.'s side of this dispute as they try to increase their defense spending. So overall, Kim, I think this is a tough picture of a world that's becoming a lot more volatile and sort of sorting in new ways that we haven't seen in decades.
Yeah, a new global world disorder. You know, Joe, there doesn't seem to be any question that this is a big problem. And what has struck me is I've seen a number of the so-called foreign policy experts ruminating in recent weeks about the potential failure on the U.S.'s part and the West's part to have done something to avoid this, to have exercised more diplomacy. But, you know, I wanted to ask you if you actually think that is something that's a reasonable critique. You know, if I go back, I think I remember the Obama-Biden Great Reset with Russia. The United States, I think, largely turned a blind eye to a lot of Russia's aggressions, going all the way back to its belligerence toward Georgia, its first invasion of Ukraine, its ties with Syria. You know, and on China, it seems like so much of the tension that's been growing has really come out of China's belligerence, its anti-democratic move in Hong Kong, its aggression toward Taiwan. I mean, is this something we could have avoided, or is this just the way it was always going to be?
Well, I definitely think there's a U.S. policy failure at work here, but it's not that one. So, I mean, as you pointed out, I mean, what this critique is arguing is that somehow if we had made more of an effort to be besties with China or with Russia, they wouldn't be cultivating this friendship with each other. I think that it is more accurate to say that both of them, plus Iran, for their own reasons, have been developing a real hostility to the U.S. and the U.S.-led order. I mean, this is especially noticeable in China, where Xi Jinping has been pushing the Chinese economy more toward decoupling almost since the very beginning of his tenure back in 2012. Certainly, Russia under Vladimir Putin has not acted as if it were keen to cultivate closer ties with the U.S. So for their own domestic reasons, they were nursing a hostility to America. I think that the failure of American diplomacy and also potentially of American military deterrence is that we did not create sufficient disincentives for them to become friends with each other as they are acting out this emerging hostility that they each feel toward the U.S. individually. That can take the form of a sometimes vacillating response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine or previous Russian invasions of its neighbors, including Ukraine in 2014 or Georgia in 2008. That kind of apparent weakness created the impression that maybe the U.S. wasn't really committed to that. It might have allowed China to think that Russia could be a useful partner in terms of distracting or somehow weakening American resolve. It wasn't that we needed to try to be friends with regimes that were never going to be friendly to us. It was that we failed to keep them from becoming friends with each other.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on that, Joe. It seems to be a lot of this is a failure of a defined policy response in so many situations. Don't forget all the way back when Joe Biden was taking us out of Afghanistan, one of the reasons was supposedly so that we could focus on China. And yet, I think even those foreign policy experts who've been actually fairly tolerant of the Biden foreign policy would acknowledge that there really is no defined foreign policy there. And Kate, I think last question here, but I think that gets to a broader failing as well, too, which is just American neglect, as it were, of its own standing and military power. I keep asking myself, would we really have seen Vladimir Putin invade Ukraine if Vladimir Putin hadn't first watched the spectacle of that chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan? Putin moved almost immediately afterward, no doubt inspired by a belief that a Joe Biden who was unwilling to see things through in Afghanistan would probably be unwilling to do anything in Ukraine. By the way, that was a good bet. So for a long time now, starting with Obama, continuing on, we have neglected our own military defenses, really sent the message that we are not going to do anything out in the world or as much as we could. What do you think that has played in terms of a role?
I think that's played a huge role in the growing disorder that we're seeing now. I think we're getting at two things, one of which is we are lacking the will to do anything. And so we see our withdrawal from Afghanistan looked so feckless and awful and not the behavior of a great power. So that is a question of credibility. Are we really going to do anything? And that's why it's so odd, Kim, every time Joe Biden heralds his Ukraine policy as such a success. I'm glad he's giving them weapons, though not enough. But keep in mind that this started because Joe Biden was calling it possibly a minor incursion, and we were taking our own assets out of the country, and we basically signaled that we weren't going to do anything about it. The other thing I just add quickly, Kim, is that our conventional military deterrent has been shrinking over the past years. And just a core example of that is the U.S. Navy, which has struggled to keep up in the Pacific. And also, it's not just the Pacific. I mean, we kept a destroyer in the Black Sea about more than 200 days a year before 2014. And our ships are just so busy that we haven't been able to be the cop on the beat everywhere around the world, discouraging bad behavior. So that decline of hard power paired with an unwillingness to do anything, I think has been really a true part of the story and the disorder we're seeing now.
Yep. I think it's an enormous part. And we're about to get a view here, too, as to whether or not the new House Republican majority is going to try to do anything about this as they get ready to put together their budget resolution, whether they can pass one, and whether that resolution both does take a little bit of an axe to domestic discretionary spending and tries to put a little bit more of it into a defense budget that very much needs to be increased. Thank you, Kate. And thank you, Joe. We also thank our listeners. We want to remind you that we are here every weekday. We'll be back tomorrow. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.